Welcome to another exciting episode of the NIDS View, a weekly show of the National Institute for Deterrence Studies, where we are advancing peace, promoting stability, and helping you to think deterrence. Each week, we will discuss and analyze a recent topic and provide insight to how it affects our national deterrence. The view of the hosts and guests are their own. We hope you enjoy the show.
Welcome back to another great episode of the NIDS View, a podcast of the National Institute for Deterrence Studies, where we come together, we talk about interesting topics. It's normally myself and Curtis and Petrosky, but today, sometimes, this happens. Jim is away on a Alaskan vacation. He's on a cruise ship watching the icebergs melt and, all that kind of cool stuff. And so now Dakota Rudisill is, he's here with us this week. So welcome in to the NIDS View, Dakota. It's great to have you.
Great to be here.
So, Dakota, for those of you that don't know him, Dakota's, he's been a Hill staffer. He's been a think tanker. He's been an intel guy. And now he's a professor in the College of Law at Ohio State, the Ohio State University. And so he's one of the few lawyers that's left who talks about and writes about, thinks about, and has experience with this concept of nuclear weapons and law. I mean, it's one of those things you generally don't think about, that, but there's a whole, we've got all the arms control treaties. We've thought about, the legality of use. There's all sorts of legal topics. And so Dakota and I were talking, we talk periodically, and I said, hey, you need to come on the podcast. And we were talking about different subjects. And I said, we've never talked about law and nuclear weapons. That's a topic that has really never come up. So why don't you come on and we'll have a discussion, and I'm sure the listeners will be interested in sort of this, this juxtaposition of nuclear weapons, the end of society, and the legality of doing it. So with that, Dakota, well, welcome to you too, Curtis. It's good.
Oh, thank
to,
you.
Good
I
to
appreciate
see, good to see you as well. So Dakota, it's not a topic I can honestly say I know much about. It's not something I really think about a lot. So why don't you sort of open us up and give us sort of a primer on, what we need to know and understand about nuclear weapons and the law.
Yeah, well, it's just great to be here. Just the expertise that you both bring to these issues, is so valuable for the nuclear community more generally, and for, our country at a time when, as we were talking, just before the show, we've had the age out of a number of generations that had a massive amount of expertise. Everyone who's in the government from 1945 on, right? We've had, probably the greatest generation, the silent generation, the boomers, right? What's left are like Xers, millennials, maybe even some Zoomers, right? But a lot of expertise has left government, the private sector, academe. And I think that's a real issue. And I think on nukes generally, but especially where I work, which is at the intersection of nukes and the law, where there used to be a pretty good cadre of people who worked on that in, again, government, private sector, academe. And it has really, really shrunk. Nice for me, but I think generally, that's kind of a concern. So with nuclear weapons and the law, I mean, we could talk about this. You could take one of my classes. We could talk about it all day, every day. But I'm gonna give you the kind of the quick and dirty just to start it off, and then look forward to talking with you. When we were talking about the episode, you posited the interesting starting point of, what would you say to the president, right, or another senior government official about nukes if you were advising them, right, as a lawyer? And I'd say a few things to them. I would hope that conversation would build upon an earlier conversation that I or another lawyer would have with them about basically the law and their job. And I would hope that the president or other senior official would come in understanding that that every job in government operates subject to the Constitution, because as the document starts, we the people, right? The Constitution is basically a contract between the people who are sovereign and you know, this new government that it creates, where the people delegate a limited part of their authority and their sovereignty to this federal government. And so everything that the government does operates within the context of the Constitution, which has as its organizing principle the rule of law and not the rule of men, as James Madison put it in The Federalist, right? So you need to start from that standpoint. And I would hope that whatever government official we're talking about, right, would understand that, right, that one is operating in that context. I would also hope that I or another lawyer would frame up for them, generally speaking, the value of law, which also operates in the nuclear context. And just the short version of that is I would say mainly three things. One is law provides authority to act. If you don't have legal authority to act, you can't do anything. And that is order employment of nuclear weapons, build a nuclear weapon, appoint an officer to head STRATCOM, doesn't matter, right? It's law provides authority to act. And in that way, it also legitimates what they're doing, right? They're not just using violence, right? It is legitimized violence grounded in the authorities of the country. Second thing law does is it provides a decision process. Sometimes very granular way, other ways just kind of at a higher level, but some sort of process for decision. And hopefully it's a robust decision process in the sense of it's substantive, but it's also timely, right? And getting those, and we can talk more about that maybe in the nuclear command and control context, doing both those things, substantive process and timely, especially hard in the nuclear realm, right? In some scenarios we can imagine. The third general thing that law does is it injects into decision-making constitutional values. And those can be things like, care for the entire country as a whole, care in decision process, understanding that you're operating subject to the rule of law, personal integrity, things like that, right? Constitutional values. So the overall context for the president to operate or other senior people is, you know, what I could call kind of national security con law, national security constitutional law. So the president is the commander in chief under Article 2 of the Constitution, which means the commander in chief, and it's right there in the constitutional text, of the armed forces, not the commander in chief of the country. Unlike the Roman emperor, the Supreme Court has underscored this. And the president commands the military that Congress provides. There are more individual provisions of the Constitution about Congress's powers over the military and national security than any other topic. Provide armies, raise armies, provide and maintain a navy, whole bunch of other things, right? So Congress has really powerful national security powers. And so the president commands the military that Congress creates, funds, regulates, limits, all that stuff, right? And then the courts, of course, are the final word on, you know, the content of the law. The bases for use of force are basically three. So one is Congress has authorized it. So Congress declared war or Congress passed a force authorization statute. That's one. A second is the president can use the president's inherent power as commander in chief for defense of the country to repel sudden attacks. That was the term used at the Constitutional Convention, repel sudden attacks. And the theory is there's an attack that's initiated or it's imminent, and there's not time to get Congress together and have Congress do its work under the Declare War Clause. The president just has to act, right? So that's repel sudden attacks. And there's some question about, how far does that preemption authority extend? Like, how imminent does imminent need to be? That's an enduring ambiguity. A third basis is what's just called, like, important interest. So the president can order the use of force to advance and defend important national interests. And so that is like activity which is sub-war, but it's still a use of force. Like, you know, the U.S. is, you know, dropping munitions on, terrorists in Yemen, something like that. It's not like war in the constitutional sense, but it's like advancing important national interests, something like that. I mean, the president can do that without congressional authorization. Getting kind of closer to nuclear weapons, the law that operates here is a combination of domestic law and then international law. And I promise I will wrap up my quick and dirty lecture very, very, very quickly. But on the domestic side, Congress using its expansive authorities to, you know, basically raise and support nuclear forces and create the military, the Pentagon, all of that stuff, right? Like, there's a lot of law about that, about, like, you know, the stockpile, building the delivery vehicles, when they're deployed, all that stuff, right? So there's a body of law about that stuff, and it's pretty thick, going back many, many, many decades. And Congress legislates on nuclear forces and nuclear weapons every multiple times a year. National Defense Authorization Act, Department of Defense Appropriations Act, sometimes more than once a year. So tons of law about that stuff. Congress has, again, obviously created the, you know, they've created the whole command structure. Congress has written a statute which delineates the chain of command under the president. The Constitution says the president's the commander in chief, or as Alexander Hamilton put it in the Federalist Papers, the president is always the supreme admiral or general. But then Congress then can structure everything below that, right? And then we have law about the use of force. There's the War Powers Resolution, which basically puts some limits on how long you can use force without Congress authorizing that. Not very relevant to nukes because, you know, so the clock under the War Powers Resolution is 60 to 90 days. We've never had a nuclear war go 60 to 90 days. Thankfully, we've had none. But that is still potentially out there as some part of some larger conflict. And then we have some international law, which is relevant here as well. And this is, international law sometimes gets a bad name. Definitely some of it is just kind of aspirational. Like a lot of the UN Charter or a lot of law on human rights issues. I mean, it's not that it doesn't matter. It's just kind of very aspirational. But there is international law that's hard law in the sense that under the Constitution, it's hard law. It's as hard as the U.S. criminal code. And so one piece of that is treaties that the United States has ratified under the Constitution. Treaties, negotiated with the president, approved by the Senate under the plain text of the Constitution. These are the supreme law of the land. And so there are treaties on regulating the bilateral nuclear arms control relationship between Washington and Moscow. There used to be a bunch of them. Now we're just down to one. We can talk more about that. And then there are other treaties about basically where nuclear weapons can be emplaced and where they can be detonated. And so, for example, these international nuclear weapons agreements, you can't detonate a nuclear weapon. You can't test a nuclear weapon in the atmosphere, underwater, or in space. You can't emplace a nuclear weapon, like base it in space. You can't base it on the seafloor. And so there's that body of law that regulates basically nuclear weapons in particular. And then just the last point I'd mention before we talk about this a little bit is what's called for people in the legal field and operation and also like the military operational art field is called LOAC, which is Law of Armed Conflict. And that's also hard law. And that's a combination of a law that's in treaties like the Geneva Conventions and also law, which is well understood to be what's called customary international law, but is incorporated into U.S. law by the Uniform Code of Military Justice and a couple other statutes. And the law of armed conflict basically regulates the methods and means of warfare and has that's a whole conversation there. But it's been it is imperfect, but it has undertaken a revolution basically in the cruelty of war. And one of its principles, basically kind of overarching macro principles, I would say, is that the law of armed conflict basically endeavors to protect the helpless in war. So it says you cannot intentionally attack with any kind of weapon a non-combatant, right? You can't direct your attack at them for the purpose of harming them. You can't use torture. If you are attacking a legitimate military target, and that's the only thing that can be attacked under the law of armed conflict, where there is incidental but unintended harm to non-combatants, their property, the damage of that unintended but incidental harm to non-combatants, that cannot exceed the value of the military target you're trying to attack. That's the proportionality principle. And that's especially hard. That's hard in regular warfare, counterterrorism. It is massively hard in the nuclear context. I'll stop right there. But that's my quick and dirty.
So that brings to mind, you know, yeah. It causes me to question, to wonder. So does that mean that, you know, a counter value targeting strategy would be illegal under, you know, international law, or is that a perfectly legal kind of targeting strategy to have?
Yeah. So a really rich topic. And as you can, you know, just imagine from what we're talking about, right? Just like lots of conversation about this, and very, very contested over the decades. So, you know, the short answer would be that, you know, the law of armed conflict says you can't intentionally target noncombatants, right? They are not a legitimate target. You know, you can only aim at legitimate military targets, which generally include the forces of the military forces of the other side, their leadership, their national leadership, systems that support the national leadership and their ability to communicate with the forces. So in the context of nukes, right, that's NC3, you know, things of that nature. So all three of those things that I mentioned, you can definitely shoot at. But shooting at those is what in the nuke field, right, we would call counter force, right? But if you're talking counter value, where you're going to intentionally hold at risk, right, humans, right, non-combatant civilians, you know, a lot of people would say that that is per se illegal. You can't do that. But there are a couple complications for that. One complication is just simply technological capacity, right? So like, you go to the early years of, you know, U.S. nuclear forces, Soviet nuclear forces, right? Like they didn't have the precision to do discrimination very well, you know, and so, you know, to defend their country, right, against existential threats, right, to like, you know, deter the Red Army in the 1940s or 50s from just rolling over Western Europe, which they could have done, right? You know, we did countervalue targeting, right? Is that immoral? You know, to prevent that from happening, right? Keep those, you know, keep all those democracies of Western Europe safe, right? I mean, that certainly complicates it. Another thing that complicates it is, you know, obviously a lot of these legitimate military targets, nuclear forces, and especially national leadership, right? Like they're in population centers, and nuclear weapons are notoriously sledgehammers, right? So it gets tough. But what I can say is that in terms of how the United States has understood the law, there was a revolution in basically U.S. nuclear targeting and the law, where law of armed conflict principles were much more integrated, starting in the 1990s and thereafter. And so we have nuclear employment guidance now, which does reflect the law of armed conflict, still heavily criticized by the human rights community, but dramatically different state of affairs than the end of the Cold War.
Yeah, because I've always wondered when Curtis he's constantly telling me, kill them all and let God sort out the dead. I mean, I've wondered is that kind of a legal thing? Because I know he thinks it's the right way to go, but you know, that's Curtis. What can I say?
No, it is threatened to kill them all. The essence of deterrence is the withheld threat, right? So let me ask this, Dakota, because I think this is key. You know, so if treaties are hard law and then treaties expire, what is the effect on law after that? Because it seems to be that the United States wants to continue to follow language from defunct treaties that constrain us. And I don't understand why we would do that if the law as a portion to that treaty is now expired.
So are you specifically referencing New START?
Well, it could be New START. How about START II, which neutered the bombers, for example? And that one's probably as good as any. I mean, we've never gone back and re-nuked the B-1 bombers, for example. And so the question is, well, why, you know, I mean, maybe certainly there's a military, you know, answer to that question, but legally, there is nothing that would prevent us from doing that, correct?
Correct. Yeah, that's right. So, you know, when START 1 expired when new START expires in February of next year, right? That is no longer the supreme law of the land. And after that point, then it becomes a question of two things. One is, you know, has Congress legislated something? And, you know, Congress does periodically write statutes about nuclear forces. And when I was on the Hill, I had a chance actually to help draft a few of those. Some made the Pentagon happy. Others made them made the generals and admirals unhappy. But that's Congress using its constitutional authorities. The other is just kind of national policy, right? Just, you know, the president, the civilian leadership, the military leadership, right, deciding how they want to size the force. You know, and what you mentioned about, like, you know, basically kind of pieces of START 2, which we basically did, right? So we got rid of the Peacekeeper, the MX that had 10 MIRV warheads. We downloaded the Minuteman force from 3 warheads to 1. We denuked the B-1 force. You know, all of those things were things that, you know, a number of administrations wanted to do anyway, just to get our numbers down in the interest of doing that. But then we also had these other agreements, right? We had the Moscow Treaty in 2002. We had the New START Treaty in 2010. And they continued to, you know, to march down the strategic warhead numbers. And so as you're doing that, you know, it just kind of made sense. Well, all right, you know, Peacekeeper's gone already. We denuked the B-1, right? It's just like, okay, let's just pocket that stuff and just kind of keep going. But you're right, right? I mean, like, if the treaty's not there and there's no statute on point, you know, DOD can do what it wants.
Right. Let me ask this one, because this is fascinating. I've been taking notes. I'm learning a lot. It's like I'm auditing your class here, so I appreciate that very much.
I won't charge you.
Oh, please, yes. Send it to the Underhills or to Adam Lowther. There's been some conversation within recently. I think it pretty much started. So a couple of things Congress has been pushing. It started at the beginning of the Biden administration. There was a push to include Congress in any nuclear decision making. There was like 30 congressmen, largely of one party, sort of asking for this requirement to sort of take this away from the commander in chief. And so that was one question, and in what your thoughts were on that. And then is this this desire, I think, this question of whether or not, and I think it's adjacent to this effort by Congress at one time. I mean, it certainly doesn't exist now, but this argument that any time the employment of nuclear weapons, that's outside of the purview of the president, which, of course, I don't believe that it is. And all the congressional guidance that I've seen out there allows this. That is, I think, falls under repulsing of a sudden attack, the retaliation, the actual carrying out of a threatened retaliation in order, you know, from a nuclear attack would probably fall under that. No time to counsel Congress on that, but Congress wanted that at one point. And I just wonder what your thoughts were on the constitutionality of that. Does that not Congress getting into the lane of the president?
Yeah, so it's here again, super fascinating issue, and a lot of a number of really thoughtful perspectives on this issue, and it's so hard. And you know, basically, what we have is the collision here of some sort of situation where you have the worst possible, you know, sudden attack, right? An initiated adversary nuclear attack on the United States, or the intel suggests really clearly, you know, they're fueling their birds. Right. Like all the indications are they're moving to some sort of strike. And, you know, we have every reason and incentive in preserving our country to get out in front of that. Right. So that is super hard. You know, so that's clearly a, sudden attacks and, president, Article 2 commander in chief situation. Right. But what's challenging about it is that it may not always be clear how how likely that sudden attack actually is, right? There can be a lot of indications that, you know, we're moving, the international security environment is moving in a really bad direction. They can start moving forces, you know, like if they've got road mobile missiles, maybe they're starting to sortie them, you know, but is this signaling? Is this diplomacy? And, you know, so it's not like, you know, it's not like the Russian or Chinese missiles are in the air. It's, you know, there's some question there. And so when you've got any time, then what is implicated is the constitutional role of Congress on war and peace. And, the constitutional text is clear, right? Congress has the power to declare war, and Congress has expansive authorities over use of force and all this hardware that they build, right? And the framers definitely imagined, you know, basically where there's some sort of question about whether the country should have a war, the constitutional evidence is overwhelming that the framers understood that Congress would be centrally involved in that. One scholar terms the president that the founders created was America's first officer, in the sense that, you know, the law is supreme, Constitution is supreme, Congress leads on questions of war and peace, Congress leads on matters of law and policy, right? And then the president is the first officer who executes that, with the exception, right, of the sudden attack, right? And so both those constitutional equities, right, are really powerfully implicated. And so there's been a lot of conversation over the years of saying, well, okay, well, how do we update this constitutional understanding, right? How do we apply that in the nuclear age? And it's such a hard issue. And I think because it is such a hard issue, and the risks of being wrong about that, right, about hamstringing the commander in chief in some sort of horrible World War III situation, right, are so great that Congress has never enacted anything that places any limits on, you know, the ability of the president to, you know, reach for the button, basically, without having to get Congress's, sign off in advance. I think it's a really tough issue, and I think it's a really tough issue because, you know, there are, you know. So I wrote an article on this a few years ago, and I said, like, basically there are kind of like three nuclear nightmares we've got. So one is the like initiated or actually really imminent adversary nuclear attack, right? And again, we can easily drop down in the like repel sudden attacks bucket, right? And you want the president, as a matter of deterrence, right? Deterrence doesn't work unless the other side is pretty confident that, you know, we can get off an attack, right? That there, any sort of first strike from the other side is not going to decapitate us, right? So that means we need a really, really agile nuclear system, you know, the president to be able to, you know, understand the intel, give an order, and have it executed before our forces are destroyed, right? So there's that. But then we have two other scenarios, and they're really worrisome. And one of them is what I, in the article, that I call the precipitous president, which is basically an impulsive president, right? A president who gets some indications from like NORAD and STRATCOM and the IC and whatnot, right? Like the situation is getting worrisome, right? But they're precipitous in the sense that they just, you know, they just like immediately go for like nuclear employment, right? When actually there's a lot of reason to think like, well, maybe not, right? The precipitous president, right? And in that context, which is a decision for a discretionary nuclear war, right? That, you know, the congressional powers over war and peace have to matter somehow, right? And then there's kind of like the worst situation, which is in the article I call the rogue president. And that is a president who orders employment of nuclear weapons, and there is no factual predicate, right? This is just the president just deciding, I'm going to do this. And, you know, there's the examples, and they're, you know, endlessly debated about, you know, historians of like, you know, drunk Richard Nixon on the phone with Henry Kissinger, or the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff saying like, we got to nuke North Korea, you know, and he's drunk and high, right? What do you do about that? Under the current system we have, there is nothing except, you know, I mean, like, that's it, right? Like, the, you know, they, you know, it is, you know, if you take those accounts from the Nixon administration, and there are about two or three of them, if you take those on face value, and again, like the historians debate about this stuff, and obviously, like, you know, Kissinger denies it, Nixon denied it, whatever, you know, but there were a number, anyway, if you take them at face value, right, well, it sounds like Kissinger and the Pentagon refused a lawful order from the president to nuke North Korea and nuke North and nuke, you know,
is it lawful
Vietnam.
If he's drunk? I mean, I'm not sure it's lawful if he's drunk.
So that is a fascinating question. And, it's just super hard. And they made the decision, right, that they were just not going to regard that as like a competent order from the commander in chief.
Well, I guess you could have the same thing if you had a mental capacity issue, non-compos mentis with your president, these sorts of things. That could be. I got one more question, and I'm going to give it over to Adam because I'm itching to ask this
last question. I will tell you, over on NucleCast, Dave Jonas and I did an episode where we specifically talked about soul authority.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, because Dave Jonas wrote a really nice article, he argued against soul authority. And so he and I had a debate discussion over, is that a good idea or not? So that was probably a year and a half ago that mm-hmm. Dave and I did that on NucleCast. But so if you're really interested on that specific topic, we tackled that.
I actually, for whatever it's worth, from a legal standpoint, I think that the ability for sole authority to launch, to not be hampered by Congress, is in fact a deterrent. It allows the autocrat threat, if you will, the adversary, the autocrat adversary, who also is unchallenged in his decision, to understand and see their adversary, us, within the same risk. And so I think there is something to say about that. So when we talk about treaties and law of armed conflict, which is, you know, largely based on, you know, Geneva Conventions and other agreements that largely many of the other nations are a party to, we've seen most of our nuclear adversaries are not necessarily very truthful in the following of their treaties. If you go to the State Department website, there's a long list of all the violations from any number of our treaty adversaries that we have signed, you know, with. And of course, the New START treaty, which you've referred to, is really a treaty of which we are in alone, as Russia has suspended it. So, you know, not sure you can be in a treaty by yourself. Not sure what the legal standing is on that. That would be an interesting annex to your course. You know, can you be in a treaty by yourself? Are you just going to constrain yourself legally? But all of this is based on this international rules-based order, right? If all of the treaties work when all of the parties want to subscribe to the treaty, right? And they want the value and the benefit of the treaty. And there's some argument as to whether or not some of the folks that have signed treaties with us actually use it as a cudgel, you know, really to beat us up with rather than and to try to constrain us, because we are so willing to be constrained by a treaty. And so my question is that when you detect treaty violations and you are unable to lawfully correct the other signatory, the other party, and they are clearly in violation, but yet they refuse to leave. They might choose to suspend. Why are we still legally obligated to follow this treaty? And as a follow-on to that, if the rules-based international order is in fact lost or not followed by a large number of nations, of which we are seeing that alignment come around, is it even possible to have treaties with these folks anymore? So I'll let you have those.
Yeah, I mean, super interesting basket of questions. You know, so interesting. I mean, so I'll just take kind of the simplest one first, in my view, which is, you know, are you bound by a treaty when the other side is not following the treaty? At some point, you know, it's just like, you know, like if you hire a contractor to paint your house and the paint's not going on the house, right? Or they were, you know, you wanted it painted blue and they're painting it pink. You know, like at some point you don't have a contract anymore, right? They're just not performing, you know, and it's null and void, right? So that's absolutely the case. I mean, on New START, as you know, so the Russians announced that they were not in 2023, that they're not going to participate anymore in the verification piece of it, and the monitoring piece of it. They said that they would still observe the numerical limits on delivery vehicles, and they said that they would observe
them. Oh, well, that's good enough.
Well, I mean, that's like, you know, I mean, like, you know, you've got the limits, right? And then you got verification, and, you know, we have national technical means, right? We got great satellites, other intel capabilities, and I think we can have reasonable confidence, right? Of like, you know, how many ICBMs do they have? How many bombers? How many subs, right? And that, for me, that kind of gets back to one of the, I think, more influential notions from the Cold War. I think it's attributed to Paul Nitze, which is the idea of effective verification. You know, and it's like, you know, are the Russians going to comply perfectly? You know, probably not, right? But, you know, Nitze's view was we're better off with getting a START treaty. We're better off with the INF, you know, that he had a big role in it. You know, if we can get like overwhelmingly they're complying, and we can, you know, when we can effectively verify that, right? Not precisely, but good enough, right? Then we can be comfortable being part of that overall arrangement with them, and we can size our forces, you know, that kind of match that, right? And I think that kind of matching piece gets to my other part of the answer, which is, you know, even if you don't have, a legal obligation anymore to do a certain thing, you know, in the nuclear context, you know, well, what's all this about? It's about strategic stability, right? It's about having all of the incentives aligned in a way that nobody shoots first. And, you know, we all live. And so, you know, even if the other side, you know, so when New START completely goes away next February and the Russians are free of the numerical limits and so are we, you know, I still think that there's probably going to be some general effort to keep, you know, our forces, their forces, our understanding of the Chinese forces, like in some sort of alignment where nobody feels like they're really vulnerable to a first strike. And so, you know, that just kind of like that, like deterrence incentive, right, could still operate. So, you know, I guess that'd be my answer to that. And I, you know, well, just kind of the larger question too, of like, you know, obviously the rules-based international order, that's a big topic for, you know, international security and foreign policy and lawyers and everything like that. But, you know, I would say that, you know, what we see often is, you know, even in pretty chaotic environments, you're still able to get agreements. And, you know, there's a lot of chaotic behavior in some areas, but it gets kind of compartmentalized and kind of like over here, you know, you actually do have like effective agreement and, you know, whatnot, right? And so like, I think we're moving in some sort of direction where, you know, it's going to be something like that, right? Like we're going to have some rules and some understandings because we've agreed to them. Some international norms are going to be followed. Others are going to be disregarded. And so I think we're just heading for just basically a more complex environment. But I think that there's still a real value for arms control in the nuclear context, if it's done well, and if there's, you know, effective verification, right? Because it can provide, you know, confidence for countries, you know, not to, you know, build out in just completely unrestrained arms racing, right? Wasting tons of money, getting to a point, you know, where we were at in the Cold War, you know, with each side having like, you know, 20 to 40,000 nuclear weapons. I mean, just insane overkill from a budgetary standpoint, from a security standpoint. You know, we want to avoid that. And so if we can cut deals, right, like, you know, the Nixon administration did, Reagan, Bush the first, you know, Bush the second, like if we can cut some deals and get, effective verification, let's do that. You know, because we got, I mean, just like think about the reductions, right, from like, you know, from the late 80s to, you know, the last decade or so, you know, from, you know, what do we have, like 12,000 operational strategic nuclear warheads at the end of the Cold War. And, you know, some thought the Soviets had about 40,000, right? And now we're talking like 1550, you know, 1700, you know, I mean, like, that's amazing. And yeah, it's imperfect. But I guess in my book, that's like, okay, that worked pretty well, right? Like the painter painted like 99% of the house the color I wanted. So like, okay.
Well, I just don't understand if the treaty is valuable to Moscow and you're not going to cheat, why suspend? And if you're going to accept suspension, Why does it not devalue the entire treaty process in the first place?
I think it's a good question.
Adam's waving the flag. He's waving the white flag.
We're long over time, guys.
Well, this is the problem with the podcast. We got to have you back, man. We got to have you back. This is awesome.
Are we out of time? Seriously?
We are out of time. Yeah.
We're about 10 minutes over, but you go ahead. I tell you what, you go ahead and wrap it up.
Let's give him the last
word. We'll give you the last word, but you got to make it quick.
Okay. Well, I mean, I don't know. I guess I forgot the point I was going to make, but anyway,
that's your last word, lawyer.
Dakota, we're going to have you back. I'd just be delighted. This is tons of fun.
Absolutely.
Okay. Well, for the sake of our listeners who, you know, this is their drive time podcast, let me go ahead and just wrap it up and say thanks to Dakota and thanks to Curtis. Great discussion. If we can't have treaties, then let's have dynamic parity. That's what we like to have. And for you, the listeners, of course, remember Global Security Review podcast. We've got reports coming out this summer, so look forward to NIDS reports that are coming. We're going to have our own version of an NPR. We've got one on space deterrence coming. We've got one looking at the ICBMs that'll be coming. So look for that. And of course, you know, there's one thing that we always want to remind you as we close this show, and that is, of course, that we always want you to think deterrence.
Thank you for listening to the NIDS View. This show is produced under the NIDS Podcasting Network, a division of the National Institute for Deterrence Studies. NIDS is a 501c3 organization dependent upon donations to provide this podcast and bring about awareness of the peacekeeping value of U.S. strength and our national deterrence. You can catch all of our podcasts or provide feedback at thinkdeterrence.com. I would like to thank our producer, Kimberly Charrington, our sponsors, and all the fantastic members of the National Institute for Deterrence Studies for making this podcast possible. Stay tuned next week for another exciting and informative The NIDS View.
The NIDS Podcasting Network.